Our guest speaker today is Dr. Daniel Straka, who is an attorney specializing in immigration and refugee law, who has worked in this field for over 20 years. He has worked for nonprofit legal immigration programs specifically. He is a member of the Palomar UU Fellowship in Vista, California, and founder of the Unitarian Universalist Refugee and Immigration Services with Education, Incorporated, or UU RISE for short. Dr. Straka will explore our moral compass regarding immigration and the UU experiences which led to the creation of UU RISE. He will also touch on some of the issues regarding immigration. The title of today's talk is UU's Rise to Welcome the Stranger, Dr. Daniel Straka.
Good morning. I'm honored today to share my calling, Justice for Immigrants, immigration as a moral issue, the development of URISE, and how you use RISE to welcome the stranger. I'm inspired by the interest of this congregation, so many of you, for social justice. And I think you're lucky to have Debbie and Leslie as leaders in your social action committee. I know a little bit about your history. You shared a plate a while back for a refugee minors program. You conducted the curriculum on immigration as a moral issue. You had a phone bank or a telephone phoning to elected officials to support the DREAM Act. That tells me that you are giving of your time, talents, and treasures. And I applaud you for those efforts. You're walking the talk. Immigration is not only a legal issue, it's a moral issue. It's not an intellectual exercise, but an exercise of justice in action. UUs often live their faith by acting for justice. We are all at different points in our journey. It is indeed good for me to be among you today, fellow sojourners, in this free and liberal religion as we search for truth, meaning, and justice. At this point, I always want to say in the American way and then take off my shirt and be Superman. I'm trapped in this body, so I'll spare you that. The strength of Unitarian Universalism is in its capacity to reflect, to search, and to reveal, to embrace diversity of belief, opinion, and culture. It is our commonality that has led us to advance social justice and to respect the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Belief means to give one's heart to. We have a rich tradition of belief. Unitarian Universalist Martha and Wetzel Sharp gave their hearts and risked their lives saving Jews from the Nazis in Czechoslovakia, and they were honored posthumously as righteous among the nations. Susan B. Anthony and Unitarians and Universalists inspired by her leadership gave their hearts to the women's suffrage movement. Unitarian ministers like James Reeb marched with Martin Luther King, giving their hearts, and in the case of Reverend Reeb, his life, when he was murdered in Selma for the civil rights movement. Faith helped Unitarian Universalists give their hearts to providing sanctuary to Central Americans in the 1980s. In the 1990s, Jean Ravenall, a fellow congregant at Palomar UU Fellowship, gave her heart to founding UUs for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, which is now a national organization. Today, thousands of Unitarian Universalists, inspired by Bill Shull's current president and Charlie Clement's former president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, are again giving their hearts to the drumbeat for Darfur to end the genocide, leading efforts to rebuild Haiti, and responding to humanitarian crises around the world and in this country. These visionaries all share a belief and were called to justice. Belief, to give one's heart to. For over 30 years, I've given my heart to refugees and immigrants. I had an epiphany in 1979 when I visited a refugee camp, Quang Y Dong, on the Thai-Cambodian border. Tens of thousands of refugees, many born in that camp, were living together, hoping against hope, and yes, believing that one day they would be free. Otherwise, why would they have been as cheerful as they appeared? Perhaps it was just a show for their children, but I suspect it differently. The human capacity to endure loss and remain hopeful is miraculous. And there I was, witnessing this mass of humanity huddled together, yearning to be free, but with a very uncertain future. I returned home and knew that as a UU I had to act. I could not help every refugee in the world, but I could help an agency which assisted refugees on a regular basis. Lamenting that there was no UU entity to help resettle refugees, I learned of the International Institute of Connecticut, a member agency of the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants, a premier non-sectarian national organization. And through that, I was able to make a difference. I took my slideshow, we used to use Kodachrome and those projectors, on the road to community organizations and civic organizations, to raise awareness and consciousness about refugees. Before long, I was serving on their board. And blessings of all, my late wife, Barb, suggested that our UU church resettle a refugee couple from Laos, sponsored by the International Institute. The church was overwhelmingly supportive. Congregants reached out in ways that only Unitarian Universalists do, with generosity, acceptance, and affirmation of the dignity of these two suffering individuals, Bunyong and Kangheo. They remain in our lives. 30 years later, I still receive a card from them on Father's Day. When Barb was alive, she received a Mother's Day card. Kangheo's son is named Daniel. If he had been a girl, she would have been named Barb. Now, I can give you facts and figures about refugees and immigrants, but Unitarian Universalists are about our stories. Each of us as individuals and as congregations has a story or several or many. And I ask you to indulge me as I share another of my stories. In the summer of 1996, Saddam Hussein issued an execution order for all those Kurds who had worked for the humanitarian relief agencies which had provided assistance to the victims of Hussein's chemical attack on his own citizens in northern Iraq. President George H.W. Bush had encouraged the Kurdish people to overthrow Saddam Hussein in 1990. They made a failed attempt. Some say it failed because the U.S. abandoned them at the last moment. In 1996, President Clinton, upon learning of Hussein's execution order, arranged for an airlift of Kurds from Iraq to Guam, U.S. territory, home of the Statue of Liberty. I was asked to go to Guam to assist the 7,000 Kurds apply for political asylum. On my way to the airport, there was a call received from the White House, and I was asked to delay because of security concerns. I eventually dispatched to Guam. There's not enough time to tell you about those Kurds who have been accused of being double agents. Suffice it to say that, in my opinion, this episode was the beginning of the step through the looking glass when asylum seekers and refugees were being charged with secret evidence but were not allowed to see that evidence. Not even the former director of the CIA, who was retained for their defense, could access the evidence. And this only worsened after 9/11 and the USA Patriot Act. Immigration has taken on heated significance with the passage of Arizona SB 1070 and copycat laws in other states. The federal government has failed to fulfill its constitutionally mandated responsibility, so individual states are passing laws, sometimes written by members of organizations considered by the Southern Poverty Law Center to be hate groups. The result is flawed law which promotes racial profiling, fear, and suspicion. As a nation, we are in serious need of humane, comprehensive immigration reform. Our laws are not family-friendly and actually go against human nature. Immigrants have children, and lo and behold, they want to be with their children. One of the unintended consequences of the $9 billion fence of the southern border is that undocumented immigrants who come to work on farms cannot go back to see their families. So what did they do as a result of this policy? They brought their families here. The waiting period for a visa can be up to 20 years. So much for family values. About half of the undocumented immigrants in this country entered legally with a visa. Some overstayed to remain with family. Until 1996, one could do that and still obtain permanent residency when a number became available. Then Congress passed a law requiring the intending immigrant to return to his or her country and then barring these mothers and fathers from returning to the United States for 10 years. Considering that 75% of immigration is for family reunification, the magnitude of this hardship is enormous. We've made retroactive grounds of deportability. We changed the rules in the middle of the game. A four-year-old, Maria, was in my office a while back with her mother. She stood at my desk, and with all the courage she could muster before the tears started, she looked me right in the eyes and said, "When are you going to bring my papa home?" Belief. To give one's heart to. I'm still giving my heart to Maria to help bring her papa home. Contrary to popular belief, marriage to a U.S. citizen and having U.S. citizen children does not automatically qualify one for permanent residence. As Dale alluded to, historically, when economic times are good, immigrants are welcomed. When times are tough, immigrants become a scapegoat for all our ills. We have let anti-immigrant partisans define the debate. They have distorted the meaning of amnesty, whose root is amnesia, and seem not to understand that amnesty is when there are no consequences for violations of civil laws, like getting at the end of line, paying a fine, and enduring years of separation from family. It is in our national security interest to bring the undocumented out of the woodwork, fingerprint screen, and grant them their human rights. Enough of the labeling, the fear, and the myths. We must stop treating the symptoms of a broken immigration policy and get to the roots. We have lost our way as a nation in respect to immigration. Have we as UUs lost our way, or are we only turned around? When Barb thought I was off track, she would say that I wasn't lost. She would just simply help me turn around. And that's one of the reasons for U-Rise. Barb and I were going to do this in retirement one day and nurture it and let someone else run it. But alas, life is sometimes short. I woke up a year after Barb's death with a clear calling. I had been in a period of discernment with my minister about going to seminary. But I realized that my calling is what Barb had envisioned, a UU refugee and immigrant agency to welcome the stranger, the new pilgrims among us. More about that in a bit. So back to the story. There I was on Guam, helping Kurds from northern Iraq file asylum claims through an interpreter. A family of four entered our makeshift office next to the porta potty on the American Air Force base. There was much commotion. The tension was high. I asked the interpreter what was going on, and he said that the mother was concerned. She was there with her husband and two young children, but that her older son and his wife and child had to leave in a separate vehicle when they were going to Turkey to get the airlift to Guam. And their car evidently broke down, and they didn't know whether they had made it out of Iraq or whether they had made it to Guam. So I got the information, went to the person in charge of Operation Airlift, which our rescue mission was called, And I learned that indeed he was on Guam with his family, and he was at another camp on the naval base. So I had him brought over, and when he entered the cubicle, his 4-year-old sister grabbed his leg, his 10-year-old grabbed him around the waist, his father grabbed his shoulders, and his mother put her arms around him. And at that moment, I could feel my own deceased mother's arms around me. When the tears stopped, including the interpreters, we finally got down to writing the asylum claim. And they are alive and well in the United States. Fast forward to the year 2000. I'm sitting in New York City at a meeting with national refugee resettlement agencies. Most of them are faith-based. It makes sense. They have the capacity to resettle refugees. Jewish Federation, Catholic Migration, Lutherans, Interfaith, they're all at the table. And there I was, a Unitarian Universalist, representing a non-sectarian agency, wondering why the Unitarian Universalists were not institutionally present at the table. I thought to myself, here's this grand and noble UU legacy of providing refuge and sanctuary and welcoming the stranger. Here is our very own UU service committee leading a glorious bandwagon of social justice, but whose mission does not include immigration representation and resettlement, and for good reason in terms of funding. And here among us are Unitarian Universalists debating comprehensive immigration reform, advocating for the rights of migrant workers and promoting family unity. And yet Unitarian Universalists do not have a seat at the table and therefore have no institutional voice in the policies regarding immigrants and refugees. That is until you rise. I founded URISE so that UUs have an institutional seat at the table, equal in expression of faith to the Lutherans, the Catholics, the Jews, etc. And here we are. We're seeking relief for victims of human trafficking, domestic violence, persecution, and poverty. We have established a clear voice of justice through the principles of a liberal religion. URISE, by the way, the first or the second U is silent. You can decide which one. The Unitarian Universalist Refugee and Immigrant Services and Education is an independent, nonprofit social service agency committed to creating a prominent Unitarian Universalist national and international leadership in immigration representation and refugee resettlement. URISE is founded on UU principles and long tradition of advocating for, protecting, and providing radical hospitality to vulnerable and exploited populations. In addition to the legal service, we conduct community outreach and advocacy programs. We have a national board and advisory committee with members from New England through New York, New Jersey, into the Midwest, down south to Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, and in west into California. They have all recognized that the time is now for our efforts to be unified. It is time for Unitarian Universalists to rise to welcome the stranger with our own UU voice, through our own UU identity. We need to take ownership of our commitments to social justice. Migration, that is the movement of populations across borders, is not going to end. How we respond to and accommodate migration is what sets Unitarian Universalists apart from other religions. We do it as an affirmation of our 7 principles. Because we freely choose to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Not each American, not each healthy person, not each person fortunate to have a passport or a visa, not each person who has enough food or shelter or documentation or education, or each person who has a particular political view, but the inherent worth and dignity of every person. URISE is a national movement for Unitarian Universalists to participate in one of the most critical humanitarian and social justice issues of the 21st century. I authored the Congregational Study Action issue, Immigration is a Moral Issue, which was combined with another on migration, and which was selected by the delegates at the General Assembly in Minneapolis last year, or in 2010. It was selected as the Congregational Study Action Issue for 2010 to 2014. You and I also assisted in writing the study guide, the curriculum. URI staff are assisting with the planning for Justice GA in 2012 in Phoenix. I hope you're all planning to be there. We are standing on the side of love with immigrant families. We are working to dismantle secure communities, which has a 50% failure rate, and to halt the use of E-Verify, which is extremely inaccurate. UUs are not lost. We at times have been turned around, but UUs rise to welcome the stranger. UUs are not all of the same mind on how to deal with the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants who work our farms, provide care for our elderly and our babies, service in hotels and restaurants, and toil in factories. Many of them have been subject to sweeping raids, which leave children at school with no parent to pick them up, and U.S. citizens and permanent residents are swept up as well. At GA in Salt Lake City, we stood witness with Larry Love, a Mormon, who spoke about his ordeal. He is a U.S. citizen married to a Guatemalan woman who has lived in the United States since 1980s. She has U.S. citizen children from a prior marriage. One morning at 5 a.m., ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, knocked on their door. They asked Mr. Love if he knew the woman in a photograph that they held up. He said no. ICE asked if his wife might know. When she said no, ICE said, "That's okay, we're looking for you." And they handcuffed her, and after a tearful scene with her children and husband, she was taken away. Her asylum claim from many years ago had failed on a technicality, and this family was now being separated. Last year, I was in Tijuana for a Standing on the Side of Love visit to visit home builds that the UUs at the UU Fellowship of San Diego in San Diego and other UUs from different congregations in the San Diego area are engaged in building. We met with members of the local neighborhood association, which was making plans for the community center. While standing at the border, on the Mexican side, we struck up a conversation with a man named Jorge. He had been in the United States for 19 years, was married, and had three U.S. citizen children. He had been stopped for driving without a license and was deported a few months before our meeting. I asked him if his family was with him in Mexico. He pointed across the border and said, "They are there. You can almost see my house from here. So close, yet so far." If undocumented immigration is a matter of national security, and I don't contend that it is, or concede that it is, because none of the 9/11 terrorists were undocumented, why not fingerprint them and do background checks, draw out the terrorists from our fields and factories, and let the others just work to feed their children? Immigrants, documented and undocumented, love their children just as we love ours. And life does seem to go full circle sometimes. 20 years after my epiphany in the refugee camp, teeming with refugees and their children, I was teaching immigration law at the University of Connecticut School of Law. I asked the student who had a Vietnamese name where he was born. Fully expecting him to say Saigon, he said Quang Y Dan, the very refugee camp on the Thai-Cambodian border at which I had had my awakening. He was one of those children whose parents, I assume, were simply putting on a smile for the sake of their children and wondering if they had hope for the future. Well, they really did, and they really worked hard. Nguyen is forever in my heart. U rises for him and for Bunyong and Concayo and for Maria and her papa, for Jorge and his U.S. citizen family, for victims of human trafficking and domestic violence, and for all those thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees and their children languishing in camps around the world right now today. One of them arrived in the U.S. last fall after being in a refugee camp from 1991 at the age of one. Her mother died last year. Out of desperation, she made it to the United States. URISE helped provide legal counseling in her claim to asylum and case management. There's no need for to be turned around as a UU. I invite you to rise with you, rise in our mission for justice for refugees and immigrants in welcoming the stranger. Let's put UUs at the table with the other faiths in promoting and creating justice for immigrants and refugees. I thank you for allowing me to share my calling today. And remember, Einstein was a refugee. I think communities change, and Dale alluded in his opening remarks about the changing nature of immigration through the years. But the analogy I use is I can feel comfortable talking to a nun who's in a habit. But if there are 10 nuns standing on the street corner, I don't feel comfortable, you know, walking in and becoming part of that group. And so I think part of it is human nature, that we tend to resist the different and seek out someone who is like ourselves. But that's for a sociologist or someone else, a psychologist, to explain that. And I think it's fear of loss, a fear of control. And it has to do with power struggle. And when people feel, whether it's real or not, if there's a perception that they're going to lose power, that's threatening to them, and so they react. Well, that's going to be interesting. I hope that some of you can join us for the workshop afterwards, because Katya Hansen, program manager at URISE, is going to be speaking to that very issue. But I think that it's a continuum, and I think some people who are anti-immigration or anti-immigrant act out of racism or from a place of racism. But that doesn't mean that all anti-immigrant people are racist or act from racism. But I think that there's an element of it. You look at the Southern Poverty Law Center has rated FAIR, which is an oxymoron, the Federation, I can't remember what it stands for, Federation of American Immigration Reform. And one of their members was the author of the SB 1070 in Arizona. But that group, the American Federation of American Immigration Reform, is rated by the Law Center as being a hate group. So I think that speaks to, you know, the part that racism plays in it. Well, I haven't seen any studies on that, but there is a good. There are some people who are here for economic reasons. They want to make a better life for themselves. They get some education and then they return to Mexico or to whatever country. Here in California, we tend to think of immigration, and especially undocumented immigration, more in terms of Mexico. But across the country, that's not necessarily the population. I haven't seen any studies. I don't know of any that speak to that directly. I just don't know. I do know that in the last year there are more immigrants returning to Mexico than there are coming from Mexico, and that's because of the economic downturn. Because if there's no job, they're not going to stay here. Katya, do you have some information?
If I just add that, I think the big concern often is whether or not the students are American citizens, because if not, without the passage of the DREAM Act, regardless of how much education they have in the United States and how much they consider themselves to be U.S. citizens, they are not legally U.S. citizens, and for many reasons they may have to return because they're not able to get a driver's license, they're not able to get a job, and so many of the families view their staying as being a futile attempt of just waiting for the other for the other shoe to drop. So I think that that may be a part of that discussion. And certainly there are some that are U.S. citizens, but the parents aren't able to come, so they didn't even bring the children with them. But also you have the children that were brought here very young, that they're not U.S. citizens. So they can get their education, but they don't have any way to implement it because they can't legally work, they can't apply for financial aid, they are required to have, you know, out-of-state tuition depending on where they're going to school. They're not eligible for a lot of the services that U.S. citizens are eligible for. So I think that plays a big role in the numbers that you're talking about.
And in terms of your daughter's situation in school, and from a teacher's perspective, the more I think about it, the numbers of youth who are undocumented, who were brought here at age 2 or 3 or whatever, and have graduated from high school and are going to college, is just burgeoning across the country. And that's why the DREAM Act has taken on such momentum, because there's an increasing numbers of students who are undocumented but have achieved academic excellence and want to go to college or are in college but then can't get jobs afterwards because they still don't have a Social Security number. And
culture.
And that speaks to why we need to have more English as a second language programs. All the studies show that immigrants learn English at the same rate as they ever have in the history of our country. It's usually the second generation that is better than the first generation. I tell the story of my grandparents all the time because they never really did learn English. And when I was about 10 years old, I used to hear, they were from Czechoslovakia, Dum to Destanish Flashit, and Neznamnich, Neznamnich. And when I was about 10, I finally asked my mother, what does that mean? And she said, you don't know right from wrong, you must have the devil in you. And it was at that point that I knew that I had been a bad kid, because that's all my grandparents had said to me. So I must have always been in trouble. Children, especially second generation immigrants, do learn English at the same rate as ever. So,
in the 1800s and early 1900s, we had a relatively open border policy. All four of my grandparents came over in that way, and I think they contributed a lot to America. So it worked out, I think. But since then, we've had obviously developed a more restrictive immigration policy. It seems that any restrictions at all will create the kinds of tragedies you described in your sermon. Are you proposing that we return to an open border policy, or do you see some sort of a immigration policy that would balance whatever concerns have created the restrictions with the open border?
Yeah, I think there needs to be a balance. See, right now, Congress sets the numbers of immigrants, and it's an artificially set number. And a lot of it's historically, they've just sort of repeated what they've done in the past. And so the numbers don't take into account, realistically, the current labor needs, for example. And so they have these numbers that are woefully low, and yet if an immigrant gets here, they end up getting a job, because the employer is going to hire them. And so we need to have an approach that is realistic based on today's world, not 1940 or whatever the workforce looked like then. That's part of it. Personally, I'm not for open borders. I mean, there are some UUs who are, you know, just abolish the borders. Let's have an open world. I still, you know, there's something about covenant and societal compacts, social compacts, that I think we need to have. But I think that we could mitigate some of the problems if we have a policy that is not so draconian. I mean, it was just mean-spirited in 1996 when they passed that law that said that if you're here in the United States and you're waiting for a visa to become available because you have a relative who's a permanent resident or a citizen and you happen to be here, you can then still get your permanent residency when that number became available. The family was able to stay together. After 1996, they said, no, you've got to go back to your own country and be visa processed through the consulate. And you're ineligible to return to the United States for 10 years because you had been overstayed or you had been unlawfully present in the United States for a period of time. That's just mean-spirited. It doesn't do anything because these families are still want to be reunited. So, and separating them for 10 years doesn't make sense. So I think there's got to be a balanced approach, and there are many pieces of it, including temporary visa programs that are so woefully low. I mean, the H program, I don't want to get technical, but there's an H visa program, and the numbers come out October 1, for the beginning of the fiscal year, the federal fiscal year, but the numbers are gone by October 2nd, you know, it's because they're so low. I think it's like 85,000, but they need a lot more than that. I just want to comment about that real quickly because there's this, it's not the governor of a state that would govern immigration laws. That's a federal issue. But I think Washington State and some other states are more friendly toward victims of violent crimes, domestic violence, and abuse. And so there may be some programs that they help identify and provide safe places for people to come forward, especially women with children. So I suspect that's something like that happened. There was she was able to get through and get permanent residency.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you.